This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us for the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Speaking to amazing experts, talking real life stories and looking behind the headlines too. And there is only one thing so many TV lovers are talking about right now. Yes, Succession, but mostly Squid Game. It has taken Netflix by storm and some schools are objecting. So should your child be watching this TV show? Are they? We were speaking to both a teacher and a psychiatrist about the impact of watching age-inappropriate content and why some of these programmes can actually be incredibly useful discussions to have around the dining table. And speaking of parenting, what are some of the big myths from should our kids always be happy to can you ever be in control of them? We were speaking to a conscious parenting coach about some of those myths and hearing your best and worst things about life as mum and dads. And turning our attention to higher education, university rankings were the big thing back in my day. You'd have a look, see where you could fit, see what you could afford. But it seems like Gen Z have got different criteria in mind when it comes to choosing where they go. We were speaking to the people behind a survey that revealed just 17% are actually caring about rankings and asking what questions should you be asking when it comes to picking a university.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon. Do you know what I'm talking about if I say the cookie game, red light, green light? What about tug of war? There is one show that is dominating not only Netflix, but most conversations as well. Squid Games has been the number one show on Netflix in the UAE for nearly 2 weeks now. Our kids cannot escape it. Have you watched it? And are they watching it? Let us know on 4001. We will be speaking to a psychologist after 3:30 if you've got any questions. You can, of course, be completely anonymous as well. Joining us now from Dwight School Dubai is John Hughes, upper school music teacher and the head of innovation and digital learning. John, have you watched Squid Games yet?
I have certainly have, Helen. Do not. I really, really enjoyed it.
I'm halfway through, so please no spoilers, you or anyone listening this afternoon. I'm thoroughly enjoying it as a woman in her late 30s. What scares me a little bit is the age group that we're hearing that are also watching it, even though it's given that 18 rating by Netflix. There is literally no escaping it. What have you been hearing amongst students at Dwight?
Yes, there are students at Dwight have seen it and have enjoyed it, but to be honest, I only wish that parents were supervising their children when watching certain scenes of it. Unfortunately, Netflix is a wonderful streaming service, obviously, to watch wonderful entertainment for all ages. But unfortunately, with Netflix, other streaming services, sometimes the content isn't appropriate, Helen. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hearing, and which is the issue at our school, across many schools across the UAE and the world.
I think for many people, it's the fact that it's kind of seeped into the public consciousness across, you know, memes, the headlines, of course. And it has really sparked this debate about what level of responsibility do we have as parents to, I was going to say police, that's not what I mean, but to perhaps have conversations with our children about what is age appropriate and what makes something age appropriate. Schools have been issuing warnings for parents asking them to not allow their kids to watch Squid Games. You know, what role do you think the school has?
I think parents should be encouraged to have open, honest discussions about safe use of digital media, social media, and shows like Squid Games. We have a very comprehensive program at our school in regards to digital awareness, which covers social media, usage of the internet, you know, YouTube, and many streaming services, of course, like Netflix. So from my own children's standpoint, we have, with Netflix, we have their own accounts they have access to, and with parental controls, with username and PIN numbers, so that we can control the content that they watch at home. So I would encourage, what we do at our school, our parents and students, encourage them to have limited access to certain content. Of course, shows like Squid Games, the concept of it itself is quite exciting and engaging, but of course, there's met some scenes in that show and many other shows on Netflix unfortunately hasn't got appropriate content. So you can limit that content for that user through your own parental controls of that account. And that's what I would encourage all parents to do.
I'm thinking, you know, my early teen years when, don't laugh, I was allowed to watch Neighbours, but not Home and Away. I was allowed to watch, you know, some shows, but not others.
I'm laughing.
I know, I've no idea what my parents were basing this on, because I'm pretty sure Home and Away was not any more risque than what was happening on Ramsay Street. But obviously, the more that my parents said, no, you can't watch it, the more I went round to my next door neighbour's house and watched it on his TV. And now, you know, kids literally have computers and content in the palm of their hands. So what kind of, you know, I've naturally got a bit of a devious mind and always have, is that, you know, surely kids are going to find a way if they want to find a way, especially if they've been told not to.
Yes, you can't control, I believe, what kids see and hear from other peers or their friends. But I would encourage parents and children to have open dialogue and conversations about the content they're watching. And then hopefully they can be empowered to make the right choices themselves. And this is what we teach and preach, basically, at Dwight School Dubai all the time. So we have a comprehensive program where we're encouraging them to be digitally aware as possible in many facets. And streaming is one issue that we have. YouTube also has content that sometimes comes across as not being appropriate either in this region or for lower age groups. But apps like YouTube Kids streams that content to be more suitable, and it's more restrictive and more educational. So there are ways for parents to monitor and have those conversations to ensure that they're watching appropriate content at all times.
Let us know, are your kids watching Squid Games? John Hughes joining us from Dwight School, Dubai.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking one of the hottest shows in the world this afternoon, Squid Game. Have you watched it? I'm halfway through, so please no spoilers. But we're discussing suitability and in conversation with a psychologist after 5:30. Speaking now, though, to John Hughes. He is from Dwight School Dubai, and their classrooms are ablaze with chat of this show. But how can we talk to our kids about this without it turning into a lecture?
Yeah, the first thing, I guess, there's that big myth. The issues that we had as children ourselves are different to what children in the present day have. Mm-hmm. We can't bring out our children the same way as we were brought up in. It's a totally different world today. The locker room talks, the corridor talks, the things they hear in the playgrounds when we were growing up was forgotten about. But today, anything that is on social media, the data is indestructible. It can't go away. So for a parent talking to children and parents talking amongst themselves, educate each other, support each other. So our school at Dwight School Dubai, we have a partnership with parents and students and teachers. And we talk to the parents about the specific risks and with the children, like reputation, image sharing, cybercam scams and bullying and fake profiles and all those other major issues. And digital footprint, that's another issue as well that, you know, from the day they're born, there's a digital footprint of their life and making sure they're very careful what they post on the internet. So we also encourage our parents to, is this a very important fact, is that at school, the content's very protected. Once they leave the campus, it's the parents' responsibility, really. We encourage the parents to try and monitor what they're doing with their social media and streaming of the internet, and like Netflix and Squid Games. So we encourage parents to check accounts and content, ensure there's filters on their apps and on Safari and Google Chrome. That you can have filtering on their Wi-Fi at home, because Wi-Fi is open source. Mm-hmm. But you can filter the Wi-Fi with Acolyte and Do. It's possible to do that. So there's many ways you can monitor and help the parents and students do the right thing with their digital media.
I think it's really great that, you know, you yourself have this role, you know, head of innovation and digital learning, because, you know, when we were growing up, it was very much a case of learning how to cross the road or, you know, putting on seatbelts. Whereas, of course, all that is still irrelevant today, but we've got this added element of education that seems to straddle both personal and school life. And the fact that you guys are taking this very seriously, understanding that some of the actions that kids are taking in their digital life can also impact their real life and, you know, job opportunities, social interactions, how they're perceived by school as well. It's really important.
to follow up on that, Helen, so, yeah, you're right. So when we grew up, it was crossing the street safely, stranger danger, all those elements of our childhood that, of course, is relevant today. Mm-hmm. But we ask these other questions you would never imagine 25 years ago, 30 years ago, I'm showing my age. Mm-hmm. Are you managing your professional reputation online? Is the content you are looking at, is it secure? And how do you handle a cyber bully? So we have these three key questions we're asking our students at Dwight School of Eye all the time. Google yourself. If you're Googling yourself and appropriate images are coming up, that's a problem. You know, having a safe and secure profile, if you have a social media account, if you're an upper teenager, for example, and having a cyber bully. What do you do here if you have a cyber bully? You can't take images without permission. There are severe laws. There's very strict laws here in the UAE, must be abided by. And we do teach our students at our school, there are laws in the UAE, and if you don't follow those laws in the UAE, there are severe consequences. Mm. So we do make sure our students are aware of these things.
And I also think it's really important, you know, that we're having conversations today, because I'm sure there are people listening going, I've never heard of Squid Games. Well, if you've got kids, they will have heard of them. And it's the same with different apps for communication, online games as well. As parents, it's really easy to go, well, that's something for younger people, so it doesn't really concern me. And so that gap of knowledge and common ground and conversation between the generations just seems to grow and grow. And often it is through in those places of silence and ignorance where there can be predators, where there can be unsuitable content. And I feel like as much as, you know, I often roll my eyes and be like, oh, TikTok, so, you know, I'm too old for TikTok. We really do need to kind of step up a little bit and involve ourselves in these conversations and this content, because it being ignorant does not serve anyone well. I'm not saying you need to go and watch this series and enjoy it, but certainly understand what it is. So if your preteen kid comes to you and be like, oh, well, you know, I'm watching this tonight, or they sneak off and you feel like they're watching it, at least you know what they're talking about. Because, it's just going to get more and more extreme as they get older, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have teaching age children myself, and I have to have robust conversations with them all the time. From my personal experience, my wife and I, from a personal level, have to be very brave and go to them every so often, give me your devices. Just do a random check. They don't like it. They hate it, to be honest. But there are times where we're like, who is this person? I don't know, Dad. I don't know, Mum. Well, you shouldn't really be following this person. You don't know that person. Mm-hmm. Same with the PlayStation, the Xbox, and online games. If you don't know the person you're playing with or socializing with online, that could be an issue. So from a personal perspective, it is a challenge trying to find a balance between digital use and non-digital use, and hoping that they have activities, recreational activities that aren't online-based. But with COVID and with online learning for such a long period of time, we're going to that post-COVID world now, hopefully, where we're opening up to a world where we've got a better balance of digital devices, social media, as well as non-digital media or digital devices. So that's where I think we're at the moment. But it's a challenge for all parents.
It's all a challenge. It is all a challenge. But it's really good to hear that schools are acknowledging the fact that this is on, it goes across the board. It's not just on parents' shoulders. If there's conversations and things being shared in school property and on school time, then we've all got a role to play. And thank you, John, for your honesty today and your insights as well. Message from Celine saying, my six-year-old daughter drew a picture of people being shot during one of the games, and we were careful not to expose her to the show. Turned out an older boy on the school bus showed her videos and memes. The worst part is she thinks it's cool and funny. Deeply, deeply worrying. John, thank you so much for joining us from Dwight School, Dubai. Really appreciate your time. We are
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about the hottest TV show in town. If you've never heard that before, then you are not part of the Squid Game gang. I am halfway through watching it. I'm not even embarrassed to say. I'm really excited to go home tonight and watch episodes 5 and 6. So please, no spoilers. But should your children be watching it is what we're discussing this afternoon. Let me know your thoughts on 4001. Of course, you can get in touch for free using the ARN Play app. Bassam saying, educating kids about social media is something we really need, but educating the parents about social media and how to deal with it is as important, if not more. Parents control remotely the usage of the internet, which websites they're visiting, how often the kids use it and how many hours they're allowed. Parents cannot depend on schools to do that. Let us know your thoughts and let us know, are your kids watching it? And if so, how old are they? Dr. Willie joining us. He is a consultant in child, adolescent and adult psychiatry at Priory Wellbeing Centre here in the UAE. And Dr. Willie, parents cannot escape the fact that kids are learning about Squid Game, whether it is through seeing videos on the school bus, through TikTok or just playground chatter. So here's my first question to you, sir. Are you watching it?
I have to admit, I am watching it for purely research purposes.
That's how it started for me. I was like, we're talking about it on the show on Sunday. Next thing I know, that's all I want to do. you're going to be watching it.
I was literally that person living under the rock for for a while, and I didn't know about Squid Game because of kind of a minor distraction of uprooting my family from the UK and moving to Abu Dhabi. So I had other things in mind. But I have started watching it. Yes, I have.
It's interesting, because I'm sure you, as a psychiatrist, probably have a very different lens that you're watching this through. And you're watching it as an adult man. I'm watching it as a woman in my late 30s. I'm certainly not, watching it as a teen or a preteen. But I'm curious about what you watched at that age that kind of potentially traumatized you, because this isn't a new thing. You know, I remember watching Silence of the Lambs at age 12, 13, or Chucky, It. You know, there've always been shows and movies around that perhaps weren't appropriate for the age of the kids watching it.
Absolutely. And I think that's the first thing I would say, is to reassure the teachers, the parents, that this is not something new. Many generations have watched inappropriate stuff before and had access to stuff like this. There have been previous shows of this genre where kids have been exposed to this, and there haven't been any long-term consequences. So most people, adults and children watching this will probably, most likely will have no long-term consequences. But there is some caution, and there are some concerns that we ought to talk about.
Well, it's interesting you mentioning schools there. We were just talking to John Hughes from Dwight, and schools in the UK have been issuing warnings. And, there are some very adult themes in there. There's intimacy, and there's certainly an awful lot of violence. So I just wondered, how come when our kids start asking us questions about can I watch it, you as a parent and as an expert, we see that 18 rating. How do we explain to our kids that that is there for a reason?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So at least in this country, there's an 18 plus rating. So it's quite black and white. It's just stuff that is meant for adults, and really it's not appropriate for younger people. Now, I know there's a subculture where I think the 18 rating will signal to 15 and 16 year olds that this is okay for them to watch. And, a rating of 15 plus might signal to younger children that it might be okay for them to watch a 15 plus thing. So I think on one hand, I think it's quite useful to be clear to, to children about boundaries around what is appropriate and what isn't. But the fact is that many parents have to deal with the reality that children are probably accessing this kind of media anyways, not maybe through actual sort of watching Netflix, but through watching clips of movies, through YouTube, TikTok. And this is a problem that many parents face.
Because, thinking back, I remember watching Sight the Lambs at Annabelle Cahoon's house at a sleepover in her bedroom. It wasn't like we had access to the internet or to phones. Kids will find a way, and I can guarantee, and I was the same, if someone tells me not to do something, not to watch something, I would definitely find a way. But I'm curious if we can use shows such as, you know, Squid Game, we've talked in the past about 13 Reasons Why, as opportunities to have a bit of a sit down and a chat with the kids about, you know, what is appropriate. Can these shows often be an opportunity?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one thing we should probably remind ourselves is that, you know, there are a subset of children and young people for whom this might not be appropriate, mm-hmm. actually. And I think, like I said, most people watch this and not be affected in a harmful way. But there are certain things that are going to impress upon certain children, young people differently, particularly, you know, more vulnerable young people and more vulnerable children who may have, other difficulties already. So I think that's important for parents to know their children. They know their children best. So I think they will know their children well enough to know that, you know, what certain issues or media or certain news in the news channel will affect them in a different way than other people. But you're right. I mean, there are some positives to be had. I think for young, older children, I think this is an opportunity for parents to have a discussion with children as to how that particular show made them feel and what they would do in a certain situation. Mm-hmm. And these kind of dialogues will only help to strengthen, in some ways, bond between a child and a parent, but also get the parents to know what they're actually watching. So I think having an open dialogue and having an open lines of communication, I think, would be my advice as to keep that communication going.
I think that's a really good point you've made, Dr. Ahmed, and that, you know, one 12-year-old can be very different to another 12-year-old. One might be, you know, quite street smart and savvy. The other might be quite shielded and very, very sensitive. So while these age ratings are hugely useful as a general guide, it does tend to come down to the judgment of a parent, which is why we do need to be educating ourselves, not just about shows such as Squid Game, which, you know, as we know, is kind of dominating the headlines, but whether it is through different chat apps and websites and games, because these things are not going away, people. You know, the last thing we want to do is that kind of chasm between what we're talking about and what our kids are talking about to grow wider and wider. Going to the text line, let us know your thoughts on this. 4001. Charlene saying, we had our versions of Squid Game when we were kids. Freddy Krueger, Candyman, you can't really shield your kids from seeing that stuff. Oh my goodness, Candyman. No name on this message. My husband says a certain swear word a lot, and sometimes my kids pick it up and say it out loud out of context. While we're laughing out inside, we wonder about the consequences of this as they grow up. Is it damaging them? Any thoughts? I sincerely hope it's not, because my children have picked up a few choice phrases from me over the years. Any advice there, Doctor?
Okay. No, I think there are certain things that are naturally going to happen, especially for younger children. I think, watching such media can be quite arousing. So there might be some immediate effects. And we all have experience of, listening to some emotionally arousing music whilst we're driving and suddenly realizing we're over the speed limit because, mm-hmm. Subconsciously we do things because it's quite arousing. And children, especially primate children like ours, are good at mimicking things. So they look at us to mimic things, sometimes quite embarrassingly. But children are innately have a tendency to mimic what they watch. And that's how they learn about mm-hmm. stuff. So there is that kind of worry and I suppose that risk of all this happening in the short term. But longer term, I think lots of other factors are at play. And it's not as simple as watching something, harmful or violent leads to what some, people worry about. Is it going to lead to long-term risk of aggression in young people and adolescents?
Some really interesting messages coming in on 4001. No name on this one. Might be for obvious reasons, saying, I was traumatised as a child after watching the movie Jaws at too young an age. Well, I couldn't get even to a swimming pool for years. I went on to marry a man from the island it was filmed, so my visit to the in-laws is double horror. And Ella, thank you, saying, I've watched it and liked it. It was recommended by my 18-year-old son. My younger 16-year-old son is not interested at all. I think it's okay for teenagers to watch if they want to, or even better, to watch with them. It's a good opportunity to discuss and talk different issues and problems in society and the world. I couldn't agree more, to be honest. I think what worries me is the thought of the kids of the kind of 8, 9, 10 age and the emulation and the easy access to violence. And Doctor, any final words for anyone who's having some heated discussions with their youngsters about watching this show tonight around the dinner table?
I think, what's important is to have that open dialogue, you know, to allow your children to, you know, have the realization that they can come to you to talk about anything, especially stuff that they've maybe been watching. I'm talking about the 8, 9-year-olds who may be exposed to this unwillingly sometimes, and they're able to come and check in with you and tell you how they feel about it. I think it's important to ask them how they feel about it. I think for older kids, I think, it can vary. I think some parents have taken the approach of watching it together to talk about issues that come up and ask them about, how they would react to things. But I would say that having knowledge about what the kids are watching and how much they're watching, I think less is being talked about how much children are being exposed to streaming media and how much time is taken away from activities that kids could be doing, like physical activity, socializing, reading, or taking up a hobby. I mean, I think the kind of detrimental effects of how media kind of takes over people's lives, young people's lives, I think can be quite negative.
And it's certainly not about demonising this programme, because it's really, really good, to be honest. So do enjoy it. Enjoy responsibly, as other mediums say. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us. You are there, as I said, at Priory in Abu Dhabi. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up very soon, no doubt.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It was, of course, half term last week for many across the UAE. And hopefully that meant some lovely family time. Probably reminded you why you love your kids and why they drive you absolutely bananas too. So we're discussing myths around parenting today. And what I'd love from you is to let me know the best and worst things about being a mum or dad. For me, I honestly get so much genuine pleasure from my kids. They make me laugh every single day. They really, really do. One of the worst things, though, is I feel like I'm just never enough. I feel like the mum guilt is real. I couldn't take time off over half term. And yeah, it's really hard. The juggle, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So the best is the joy, the worst is the juggle. Let me know yours. Today we're discussing myths around parenting. So everything from, you know, trying to have a baby, raising little ones, teens as well, as we're joined live on the line by Luz Maria Vilgar-Circo, the CEO and founder of Positive Living UAE, hypnotherapist and a certified conscious parenting coach. Luz Maria, thank you so much for being with us today. Before we start talking myths and get on to some of the messages we've already had about the best and worst bits of parenting, I wondered if you could explain a little bit about what conscious parenting is. I feel like I've done a fair bit of unconscious parenting over the last few years. How do you explain it to someone who's not familiar?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Helen, for having me here.
You're welcome.
I am in awe to you to be able to do these kind of shows, because I think it's so much, I think motherhood or parenting in general is underrated. It's such an amazing experience, yet it's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And difficult in the sense of the juggling, like you said it very nicely and very wisely. And conscious parenting is a method, it's a style of parenting that was created by a very dear mentor of me, Dr. Shefali Tasabari. She is an amazing clinical psychologist that has experience for the past 33 years. And she, in fact, wrote a book about it, and it's called The Conscious Parent. And let me read you the definition of conscious parenting, because I think it's amazing the way she described this. So she says, conscious parenting is the ability to raise our children happy and free of the parent's ego and personal desires and personal agendas. So basically, yeah, not forcing the parents on standards of behaviors into their children. Conscious parenting is a term used by various psychologists to describe a style of parenting that usually focuses more on the parent and child connection. How beautiful is that?
Oh, I just got goosebumps. But I am intrigued how this applies to us in day-to-day terms and practical ways. We were discussing some of the myths around, I mean, I think parenthood in general is packed full of myths. Everything from, you know, it's going to come naturally to, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And we've already had messages coming in on exactly this. Emily saying the best thing is the cuddles, the worst thing is the sleep issues. Yes. Jake, I love how you said this. Jake saying the best thing is saying, Dada, I love you. Oh my goodness, love. Love spelled WV. The worst thing, changing diapers in a mall. I think I have to say, even these days, women do have the better facilities. Shilpa saying the best thing is seeing them to grow up being intelligent, God-fearing individuals. But the worst thing is when they tell you about the times they get bullied for being themselves. Shilpa, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Specifically, parenting myths are under the microscope this afternoon. We're joined by hypnotherapist and conscious parenting coach, Luz Maria Villagrasirco. She is the CEO and founder of Positive Living UAE. Let's go through the seven myths of parenting. And I actually mentioned one earlier, which is that parenting comes naturally. This is such a myth to me, because in moments it can feel like the most natural thing in the world. Sometimes it feels like the biggest struggle and you can do absolutely nothing right. Why do you feel like this one's really kind of sunk its teeth into us as a society?
Well, I think that is one of the most common, because we have make most of us parents and or parents to be, we have this perception and a move in our heads that parenting, it's okay, you'll figure it out once the children are there, you will know what to do. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes you think, okay, I'm going to do what my mom did to me, right? So I'm going to do exactly how my mother raised me, I'm going to do that again. But so traditionally, if I have to speak about the model of parenthood, it's always very linear, it's very hierarchical, it's very authoritarian, right? So we see the child as the lesser than, the not knower, the not knowledgeable. And we see ourselves, the parents, the ones that know everything. And what conscious parenting is suggesting is that no, we should give the opportunity as well in this parenting experience that we are facing to allow our children to teach us, to also allow us to guide them, and so that they can also guide us. And the children can teach us so many things. And among those things are living in the present moment, for example. Another thing that we can teach or that we can learn from our children is letting go of our ego attachment, of this idea that we know everything. Another thing that also children can teach us is to be joyful on the experience of parenting. So these myths that we buy into are only myths. The other myth that I can also say it's very common is that we must control our children. We must have control over them. So chance, we should control it.
Chance would be a fine thing. But I mean, often, and I understand why that's something that our parents aspire to, myself as well, you know, because we think that by controlling, that means we're going to be in control of our lives and that we're going to get to school on time and that they're going to be well behaved and we can take them places. I mean, no one wants children that are out of control, though, surely.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we tend to create control, but what we actually in our mind, in our subconscious mind, we're thinking, no, we love them. We know better for them. It's because we love them that we want them to study, that we want to be achievers, that we want them to be number one in the school and, you know, thrive at everything they do. It's because we love them. We know what's best for them. But do we really know? Do we really know? Why can we not also allow a little bit of room that they can show us their authentic selves, that they can show us as well their own sovereign beings? Because we all do have. It's just that we, the parents, need to give the opportunity for our children to show us who they are as well. The other myth that I would say is important is that we must raise happy children.
Oh, now it's interesting you should say that, because we'll talk about that next. Is that a myth to you, that we must raise happy children? And what happens if we don't? Well, many of you getting in touch with the best thing and indeed the worst thing that you're finding with parenting. Anup, thank you for this. Saying the best thing is seeing them become really good at something they love to do. The worst thing, it hasn't happened yet, but they will move out and live their lives and make their own decisions. I hope I'm prepared for that moment.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing parenting myths this afternoon with hypnotherapist and certified conscious parenting coach Luz Maria, the CEO and founder of Positive Living UAE. You mentioned one of the most common myths is that we must raise happy children. And I feel like we want to do that so desperately. You know, we've talked in the past about parenting styles, snowplow parents who want to move all obstacles and difficulties out of their children's way to make sure that they never have to have any issues at all, but also not being perhaps that mindful that this can be to their detriment. Why do you feel like it's a myth that we must raise happy children?
Thank you, Helen. Well, that's the holy grail, right? When you're a parent, you want to make your children happy, 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 but they're not going to be happy, actually. That's a myth. They're actually going to be unhappy most of the time. They're going to be crying. They're going to be dissatisfied. They're going to be discontent, because that's the human experience. That's our human condition. Mm-hmm. Our children are here to show us how to be grounded. As the parents, they need to express their humanity, and we should not freak out and panic when they do that. So basically what a child is telling the parents is, mom, dad, be a witness for me. Get grounded. Get present. Be a container for me so that I can feel my emotions. Don't fall apart every time I fall apart. Mm. Do you see? So they need us to be solid, mature, and witness with compassion and take care of them.
That's really interesting. You know, we were talking not so long ago about putting kids in car seats. And one of the reasons that parents were saying they're not is because their children don't like it and they don't want them to be unhappy. Being a good parent, I am starting to learn, sometimes means not your kids not liking you very much. And, you know, that can be dealing with tantrums, strapping them in, or, you know, We want our kids to be happy. Of course we do. But as you say, that's not the human condition. It would be kind of weird if we were all happy all the time. You know, you need light and dark. But we want to see smiles on our kids' faces. That is, I understand that as a parenting instinct, but that perhaps doesn't serve them to try and make them happy all the darn day.
Absolutely. They need us to be solid, to self-regulate ourselves, the parents. That's why Dr. Shefali, this amazing clinical psychologist, said that parenting is not about the child. It's always about us, the parents, self-regulating ourselves so that when they trigger certain emotions in us, we must own our emotions. The trigger is always in us. They might click the trigger, but the gun and the bullets are in us, the parents. So if I would translate that for little children, that will mean that they said, please, mom, be just solid, mature, and witness me with compassion. And a teenager would say, allow me to take my own decisions. Please guide me. Please coach me. But allow me to take my own decisions. Because don't we all want to raise independent kids?
Yes.
We must teach them independence. How can we want independent kids when we don't allow them autonomy?
I want to go to the text line, because we've had a number of questions about conscious parenting and some struggles that people are having as well. So 4001, let us know what's happening in your family. You can be anonymous if you prefer. But Katya's been in touch on 4001 saying, I've got a question regarding conscious parenting. It's a great idea in theory, but in practice, I find it quite exhausting at times. My 10-year-old daughter is a fab kid, but has a fair bit of attitude. I try the whole, that must be really hard for you, empathizing, and other phrases, but it just seems to wind her up more. Any advice? I can see you nodding on Microsoft Teams, so I'm sure this is a frustration that other parents have come to you with. What would you say?
Well, that's a very typical example, because we tend to, you know, she's making you uncomfortable, she's saying, right? It's very difficult to be this conscious parent, but at least you own it. It's me, the one having the emotions, the parent. My daughter is doing something. Mind you, she's an immature human being who needs coaching and guidance from you. But if you are not in charge of your own emotions, the triggers, this, you know, self-regulation, then how are you going to guide and, you know, coach your daughter? So see yourself with compassion. I'm saying see yourself with compassion. Ask, make a compassion inquiry within yourself and say, what is it in me that the behavior of my daughter is causing me first? Mm-hmm. Acknowledge that, heal that, self-regulate, and then see your daughter after seeing yourself with compassion. See her as an immature human being that needs guidance. You see, children come to us as a seek of guidance. We are the mirrors, the parents, so that when they see in us, they see a solid, mature, self-regulated being so that they can feel safe.
Even if that means that I'm crying into a pillow and screaming behind closed doors. They just don't need to see that bit. I love this message, and it's anonymous on the message app, saying, I love my children. I'm 100% confident I will give my all to them forever. But does it get easier? They're 20 months and 4 years old. I don't know, because my kids are 4 and 6, and everyone I speak to about, you know, does it get easier, they say, well, small kids, small problems, big kids, big problems. And I wonder if anyone out there who has teenagers or grown-up kids would like to share their thoughts on this on 4001. What do you think, Luz Maria? Is it easier, or is it just different as kids get older?
Well, it gets easier if you let go of the control, you see, because you're trying to control the feelings and the behaviors of your children. That's why it's so difficult. But if you let go a little bit more from your own expectations, from your own, you know, movie that you have of who you want your child to be, I promise you, it will get easier.
And not just who we want our children to be, but also who we want to be as parents. You know, we seem to hold ourselves up to these ridiculous standards. And I don't know whose voice it is in my head. I don't know if it's my parents or if it's a social media voice or an expert I've never met. But I think almost every parent I know feels like they're not doing a good enough job. And I don't know whose standard we're holding ourselves to. Julie's saying, loving our children is easy most of the time. Parenting is the hardest part of our relationship and parenting journey.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking parenting this afternoon, busting myths. We're joined by the CEO and founder of Positive Living UAE, Luz Maria Vilgras-Circle. She's a hypnotherapist, a certified conscious parenting coach, and taking your queries. And here, if you need a shoulder to cry on or a bit of a rant, 4001, no name on this message, saying, I've got two daughters, one's 16 months, the other is 2 months. The two-month-old's been in ICU twice. We don't have a nanny. My husband and I are sharing childcare as we're working opposite shifts. My 16-month-old has screaming tantrums, throws things, and I don't know what to do. I know she's been through so much, we all have, but I feel like I'm losing my mind. Now, I know you're not supposed to say this about your own children, but I found that age, that kind of 16-month to 20-month time, really, really challenging, because I couldn't reason with my kids. They were becoming physical. It's a really, really hard time. It really, really is. And that's when tantrums do tend to come out. And as you're saying there, you know, lots of disruption with the little one in ICU. Luz Maria, what would you say to this parent, this mum who's having a tough time with a 16-month-old?
Absolutely. And this has a reason, Helen. This has a reason and a valid reason. At that age, the child is developing the role model of relationship, is learning to understand who is around that child, you know, is learning the attachment, the relationship with the most important people, the primary guardians, the mother. I don't know if you know this, but there is, in fact, a theory that was discovered by John Bowlby, who is a very famous psychologist. And he has this theory of the attachment theory. And it is between the ages of 0 to 3 that the child develops the first imprinting, the blueprint of how this person will relate to everybody. So in the attachment theory, there are four types. The secure attach, which is the child that feels really safe and in a very good, solid relationship with the parents. And that is when the child has the availability to be with the parents. And again, this is something that is biologically develop, and it is in the first 3 years, 0 to 3, that the child understands, am I safe? Am I secure? And it is for the availability of the presence of the parents that they will feel that secure attachment. So it is true, 0 to 3, it's a very crucial age. They are developing the most important layers of the brain stem, which gives them this flight, fight, freeze mode. And this is why some children cry a lot and they keep crying and lots of tantrum, because they want to know, am I safe, mommy? Are you there? Are you around? I need you. Mommy, mommy, mommy. You know that they even call it the terrible two in some countries, right? Because that's when the child is actually developing this first layer of the brain stem that needs mommy, needs to feel secure and safe. The second layer is the limbic brain, which gives them the, you know, the confidence, the self-esteem. How? Again, by the mother being there, being attentive of the needs of the child. So mommy stays with me, plays with me, I spend time with mommy, I must be worth it. I must, you know, I must be important to mommy.
That's so hard, is it? And that's a hard thing to hear as a working parent, I have to say. So
I know. And it's not necessarily the time that matters, but the quality. Mm-hmm. Even if you stay there for 1 hour or two with the child, being there gives them that security, that sense of, I'm safe, I must be worth it. Mommy's with me, I see her, I have her with me. And the third is the cognitive or the cortical brain, which is the cognitive part, you know, the intelligence, 0 to 3. How crucial is that? I cannot emphasize how important is 0 to 3. 0 to 3 is a very important age in the child's developmental trauma on their attachment styles that they will have for the rest of their life.
And we've discussed attachment theory when it comes to romantic relationships as well, which is very interesting. If you want to check out the podcast on that, Dr. Thryana exploring this just a few weeks ago. Thank you so much for your time, Luzmir. I really, really appreciate it. Alison saying on 4001, my daughter's just 12, but yesterday I was talking to a friend with adult children, and he says the mistake he made was trying to be their friend rather than their parent. We will, of course, be continuing these discussions and taking your questions too on future shows. And if you want to find out more about conscious parenting, you can find Luzmir at Positive Living UAE.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We're discussing higher education this hour. So are you saving up for your child's university? How much are you hoping to save? Where are you hoping they're going to go? Is it perhaps one that you attended, somewhere you've got your eye on internationally? I do hate to break it to you. Your decision, your choice might not be the same as theirs, because a new study has said 72% of Gen Z students, so those born 97 to 2012, believe that a university's capacity to give them skills they need for the future is more important than its ranking. Now, universities traditionally really traded off this ranking, being hugely important in the industry. But if no one wants to go, it's kind of irrelevant. So really keen to get your take on this today. Only 17% of those surveyed believe it's important to go to a highly ranked university. And these high rankings are often equated to prestige, exclusivity, and yes, mega fees as well. This is being challenged by this generation. This is really interesting. We're either going to see unis adapting to changes or holding on to decades-old belief and system. Dr. Parvez Khan joining us now, Vice President of the Global Market Research and Insight into University Partnership Programme, who put this together. Really interesting insights here. And I say that as somebody who is definitely not a Gen Zer, Doctor. And there was much discussion at university, and it was really linked to prestige. Oh, it's, you know, an Oxbridge, Ivy League. Tell us a little bit about why you feel this survey is so timely and important.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Hannah, for inviting me to come and join you again. Look, Something like 6 million young people go to a different country to study, often overseas, often to the US, to the UK, to Canada, Australia, and so forth. And, you know, the economic imperative to study abroad is still strong. You know, it's about getting that fantastic career. But what we're finding with young people is when they're making that decision about what university is best for me, they're using a much broader set of metrics than perhaps we've seen mm-hmm. from previous generations. So, for example, ranking. You know, it's been the go-to for many generations. But ranking in itself is quite a narrow measure of judging that university. And what we found with our research is this young generation, Gen Z, they are using a different set of lens, let's say, to judge a university. So they're looking at things like substance over style. Is this university going to give me the skills I need to succeed in life, not just in a career, but to be, you know, an adult? Mm-hmm. Are they going to give me those kind of life skills that I need to be successful?
It's really interesting because you know, for the longest time, certainly out of the UK, you'd look at that, the Sunday Times University, Good University Guide, and you'd have your parents kind of looking down and trying to figure out, are we in the top 5? Are we in the top 50? You know, where does my kid fall?
Well, and that is still really important.
It is.
But they're still looking at those things. I mean, they are still absolutely looking at those things. We're not saying that ranking is not important. It is one of those measures. Mm-hmm. What we're saying is that young people are thinking more judiciously about those rankings because they're bringing in a number of other metrics as well. So it's not just rankings. And I think that's the point of this research, is it's not just about rankings. Rankings is one of those measures. So I wouldn't want anybody to read that report and go away with the conclusion that ranking doesn't matter. It does matter. But the point is, it's one of those metrics. But other metrics like, am I going to get the skills that I need to succeed in life? And also, am I going to get the skills I need to be a good person? Because young people, what we've seen with them is they see themselves as change agents. You know, they see themselves as the generation that's going to make the world a better place. They're going to fight global climate change, inequality, for example. And going to university is also about equipping them with those types of skills. So there's a host of other things that they're looking at. And I think what's really interesting about this research is we need to give them that sort of agency to make decisions with a much broader set of metrics and not simply ranking, because it's just one of those metrics.
Do rankings play the majority vote when it comes to where you are deciding to send your child, or indeed in their point of view? I know for me, a lot was to do with course selection, and I know an awful lot of people made a decision on the gender split as well. So let us know yours. 4001 still saying, good ranking does matter so much. Primary institutes attract better minds and quality teachers. When I think of my friends, my best friends are the ones I met in college. A good environment means you learn from shared ideas, and these connections and relationships are for life. Sunil, thank you so much for that. We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
How did you choose which university to go to? How closely were you looking at the rankings, a university's reputation? Let us know, and ultimately how this next generation could be choosing is very, very different, because a study has shown that, well, 86% of Gen Z students consider an institution's track record on social issues when applying to university. They are truly woke. 72% really looking for university to give them the skills they need for the future. 17%, however, only that amount think it's important to go to a high-ranked university. Joining us to tell us more this afternoon is Dr. Khan, Vice President of Global Market Research and Insight at Into University Partnership. I find this really interesting, and it's been a while since I've said the word COVID, Dr. Khan, but I wondered, do you think the pandemic has an impact on this generation and their decision-making?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's been a time that's been intersected with so much other things going on, you know, so much more social activism. We've seen, you know, what happened with George Floyd in the States, and that's really had quite an impact on young people. But it's also been a time when there's been lots of concerns about global climate change and just inequality generally. COVID has really highlighted health inequalities and other social and economic inequalities to young people all across the world. And let's not forget, a lot of these young people also have parents that were laid off as a result of the pandemic. So they really saw firsthand the impact on the work in life. And a lot of them are figuring out, do you know what? I don't know if that's the kind of life I want. You know, they've really reevaluated the notions of success and how to be the best version of themselves. And that is feeding its way through their education. COVID hasn't dented that passion for learning, but then they're looking to education as a pathway to career success, absolutely. But it's more than that. It's about, you know, helping them succeed in life in general, equipping them with all those skills. And therefore, it's not really that surprising that they perceive that a degree from a prestigious university is no longer a ticket to success and happiness.
No guarantees in life, as you say. And I'm glad you mentioned money there as well, because high fees, a huge issue. If you want a good uni, you know, be ready to prepare for it and pay for it. Parents hiring advisors who can guide their children how to get into the top unis. And I think that's just a really interesting way of looking at it, Dr. Khan, that students are looking for a different way, rejecting perhaps the old stereotypes and tropes and wanting to get that work-life balance, social change, looking at working and living in a completely different way. So why wouldn't this apply to education? If anyone wants to read more of this survey, Dr. Khan, what's the best way of finding out?
Oh, do come onto our website. So it's intoglobal, that's intoglobal.com, and you'll find on our corporate site access to all our press releases and our research. And this is one of many surveys we're going to be doing on Gen Z, because we really want to understand, you know, what are the things that really matter to them in life, because that will ultimately impact on their educational decisions and what they want to get out of their education. Like you said, Helen, it's a huge investment. You know, they are paying thousands of pounds or thousands of dollars for an education.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Absolutely want that return on that investment. So, you know, what we're seeing with these young people is they're pragmatic, they're resilient, and they're looking for tangible outcomes from their education. And therefore, as education providers, we need to listen to you know, what those young people expect.
Really interesting. We're going to be exploring this further next. Thank you, Dr. Khan, VP of Global Market Research and Insight at Inter-University Partnership.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Discussing higher education this hour and asking, are prestigious universities all that? Maybe not, according to a new survey. What uni did you attend, and do you feel it's led to career success? Let us know on 4001. You can use the ARN Play app, joined now by Hugh Martin, the Registrar and Chief Administrative Officer at the British University here in Dubai. Hugh, tell us a little bit about your decision-making process when it comes to picking a university.
Oh, well, that's a tough one. Hi, Helen. Thanks for inviting me on, and hello to your good afternoon to your listeners. Yeah, that was a long time ago. My grey hair, which you can't see on the radio, but look, I was lucky. So I was leaving school at the end of the 80s, and for those who remember that far back, I got to choose a university in the UK based on what I wanted to study. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't so much about what the job was or how much I was going to earn later. I happened to love literature. I happened to love writing and poetry, so that's what I studied. But these days, as you know, it's much, much tougher. And the kind of pressure that are on students now from society, from families, from their schools, about what career they're going to get, what they're going to earn, means it's much, much harder for them to pick a subject that they may really love. And they may end up doing something which they've been pushed into. And, you know, this is 4 years of their life, the most important 4 years, many people say, of your life. 3 or 4 years of your life doing something you don't enjoy, is that what we really want?
And also, as you say, the pressures, it kind of goes away from learning for the joy of learning. It goes to how employable are you going to be? How much are you going
to earn. And I would love to say, as a parent, my children can do what they want, if you know, learn a trade, go to university, don't go to university. But there is a nagging part of me that goes, I would like them to go to uni, I would like them to go to a good one. And it's interesting to see the results of this survey of Gen Z students, as I said, those born 1997 to 2012, who are saying that university ranking actually isn't that important to them. It might be something that's important to their parents, but when they put these factors together, they're looking at perhaps a place that's got a good social conscience. They're looking at some way of having a good life balance. And so I just wondered, from your point of view, talking to parents and kids and reviewing applications, what are you observing, Hugh?
I think, what's really reassuring in some ways that this is students saying that. And I'm not just saying that to pay lip service, because I think one of the things you've probably experienced, Helen, both at uni yourself as a parent, but also because of different cultures that we live and work in. If you're in the UK, if you're in Australia, if you're in the US, when you're 18, you tend to make a lot of decisions yourself. We would speak to students, not parents there. And I know coming here, that's different. I speak to parents and they're making decisions for their students. So it's kind of reassuring in some ways to hear that students are saying this, because I really care what they want and I care what they think. And the idea about ranking, I go back to the former vice chancellor of Oxford University, where I was lucky to go, and he said, "I hate league tables." This is a bit shocking, really, to hear that.
Yes, it's easy to say that when you're at the top of them.
Yeah,
though.
Well, you've kind of preempted what I was going to say. You're right, because he said, "Except when I wake up and find that Oxford's number one." So it does, and look, it's a nuanced business. Rankings and league tables do help, but when you're 17 or even younger, and you're making those kind of decisions, you don't know what the ramifications will be for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Where you study, the people you're going to meet, all the things that people don't tell you about. If university was just about getting a degree, we could carry on doing it online and give it to you in a piece of paper on an iPad. But we all know that that's not what university's about. And it kind of makes me a little bit angry sometimes when I hear people talk about, we just need to get more students ready for jobs. Because university is not about job ready. It's about making people life ready. If they get the right kind of experience at university, they will be ready for any job. And yes, some of that will be well-paid STEM jobs in engineering, in medicine, in maths, but others will be artists and musicians and creative types and teachers. And so, taking a bit of pressure off students and helping them make a decision that will be best for them for jobs that we don't even know exist yet. We won't know what they're going to be doing. Mm-hmm. I turned 50 this year and I've done three completely different careers.
And that's going to be the future. That absolutely is. As we live longer, we're going to have more of that pick and mix approach, and you might study something at university and you probably won't be doing it until the day you die. And it's interesting when we have guests on the show, Hugh, we always get their bios over, and the university they attend only tends to be included if they are those prestigious ones. Do you think it's going to look different in the future? Will the names of universities perhaps not matter as much as they have done currently or in the past?
Okay, I'd love to say completely, but again, I think it's always going to be shades of grey in this. There will always be an Oxford or a Cambridge or a Yale or a Harvard. There will be these names, and they've been around for over 1,000 years in some cases, so that doesn't come lightly. At the same time, I'm just really excited by the fact that I've worked across the sector. So I've worked at the very best universities in the UK and US, but also at some of the ones which you would call the bottom of the league table. And they're just as exciting places, and they're just as important, mm-hmm. and they give just as great education. It's just different. There's a space for all of us in this sector. It's a huge sector. And if it wasn't, we would be all being channeled into one subject and one place. But the key is to make sure students, particularly, wherever they go, get the best experience that they can get. So it shouldn't matter whether the badge is a famous badge or not. It should matter that they're getting a fantastic experience when they get there, they're not being shortchanged, and that they're not getting ripped off. Mm-hmm. And that the parents are feeling, because I get it, look, I understand when parents say, but I want him to be a doctor, I want her to be an engineer, because they're worried about their future, the careers of their kids that they don't yet know about. We just have to have a little bit more faith in them, because they're bright and they know what they want.
Can I ask what kind of trends you're seeing when it comes to higher education, when it comes to masters, for example, whether that is ages or subjects? How many people are getting involved and what are they focusing on here?
Yeah, we see a lot of that. Obviously, in my university here, we are a postgraduate-only university until recently. So we specialize in masters and PhDs. So, and in the UAE particularly, almost all of our students are part-time, which is rather different to what I was used to say in the UK or in America, because all of our students are in work. They have husbands, wives, families, lives. They have jobs. So they're coming in the evenings. They're coming the weekends. And so they tend to be doing masters which are applied in business, particularly in project management, in legal dispute resolution, in sustainable environment. Those those kind of subjects which are applicable to the jobs that they're actually in. Mm-hmm. And for me, this is going to be a huge burgeoning area, not just in the UAE, but elsewhere, because this is about lifelong learning. And that's where industry really takes its part. You know, this is about training people who are already in good jobs, but upskilling all the time. Because as you said, none of us know all of it when we come out at 22.
Know anything at 22. But no, it's interesting because my husband did his master's in a couple of years ago here in the UAE and did exactly that. Over a couple of years, was studying at night, studying at the weekends, has now pivoted as a result of that master's and is hugely happy. But I think it does take a certain amount of, well, I mean, when I think about what I would study now compared to what I would study at 18, it's a very different educational cycle and mindset. What are the age of the people that are doing masters that you're seeing? Is it their 20s, 30s, 40s?
It's a good range. I mean, they're probably a little bit younger than I might have expected. So there are people in their mid-20s. Look, I did my master's. I left business after 6 or 7 years, and I went back for the very same reason that your husband probably did. Mm. Here we're seeing them up to, certainly through the 30s and 40s, and doctorates being used as well in a way that we wouldn't have seen in the past. You know, in the olden days, if you did a PhD or a doctorate, really it was to become an academic. Mm-hmm. And now there are people doing it. They're very, very, you know, interested in research and as it applies to R&D in their industry. In their business, so or in their government, particularly here, a lot of people working in public or government offices where this will have a genuine benefit to them, and it's probably nothing to do with what they studied when they were an undergrad 20 years ago.
Hugh, lastly, before I let you go, any advice for parents, children, teens, students who are choosing a university, looking ahead to perhaps starting next September? What are the questions they should be asking themselves and each other?
Okay, so I'm going to probably shock some of your listeners now. Apologies to the parents in advance. To parents, I'd say, back off. And I know how hard it is, and I know it's tough, and I know you want the best for your students, but let them tell you what they want and what they're good at. They have the rest of their lives ahead of them. Don't force them into something they won't enjoy just because it might have a big price ticket at the end, because, by the way, that price ticket might change. They may not earn that much, or they may give it all up. To the students, I'd say, think beyond actually the rankings. Think beyond the subject you're good at school. What other things do you want? Because university is about so much more than just your degree. The people you're going to meet, the place. Some people prefer big cities. Some people like a quiet campus. Think about opportunities to travel. I know it's not great at the moment with COVID, but it will come back. Does your university have good study abroad options? Are you going to meet people from different backgrounds and cultures and religions and really, you know, challenge yourself? Because it's too easy to be comfortable. And when you're only 17, things it's a big, scary world. But once you cross that threshold at 18 and you go to uni for the first time, it all opens up. So seize it. Grab it.
Brilliant advice. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Hugh Martin speaking to us from the British University in Dubai. We talk education every single Sunday. Is there any hot topics that you want us to focus on? Let us know on 4001.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.